U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Jobless claims go through the roof, and electoral politics tries to adjust to the coronavirus age. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jugot. We are joined by my colleagues Kim Strassel. Hello, Kim.
Hello, Kyle.
And Bill McGurn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, happy Friday, Kyle.
You too, though the news is not quite so happy. The economic headline out of the Labor Department this morning was the new unemployment figure. Shows the national unemployment rate up to 4.4% from 3.5% a month earlier. But that figure does not seem to reflect the economic damage that took place near the mid and end of March. A better indicator seems to be the number of people filing new claims for unemployment benefits. Last week, it was 3.3 million, which was about five times the previous record. And this week, the number is 6.6 million. So that means, Bill, that around 10 million Americans have lost their jobs in the last few weeks.
Yeah, and for a lot of them, it's not just their jobs. It's their health insurance is going to expire for a while. So again, it brings us back to the issue of when can we start the economy going again? And, you know, I don't look at it as quite as stark. I think our choices are a little more nuanced, and I'd like to see more attention to the kind of midway solutions. I don't think we're going to fully open the economy for a while. Some people worry that we open it right away and then things go up, cases go up, and then we shut it down. I'm not sure how happy that is. But I do think that we should start looking at specific parts of the country where we could reopen the economy. And then also reopening kind of the way some other countries are doing with restrictions. So it's not a total reopening, but it gets a lot of our lives back. For example, in Hong Kong, they've done the they banned the schools, kids from attending schools and so forth, a lot of the big gatherings. But they also have kept the restaurants open by instituting social distancing at the restaurants. There's hand sanitizer free everywhere. And very big, they have a lot of testing and a lot of tracing, and they have mandatory quarantines. They've put a couple people in jail who have been required to quarantine and were flouting the rules.
The White House says that it is trying quickly to get the $2 trillion in aid that Congress passed last week out to these workers who've lost their jobs and these companies that are struggling. At Thursday's coronavirus briefing, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said that the cash payments to Americans will start hitting in about 2 weeks, beginning with the people who whose direct deposit information the government always already has. The $350 billion in forgivable loans for small businesses, which is intended to support their payroll so they don't do more layoffs, that's going to be available starting today, Friday, via local banks. And Mr. Mnuchin urged companies to please bring your workers back to work if you let any of them go. And if that $350 billion fund runs out, he says he'll go to Congress for a refill. Kim, how do you think the administration is doing in standing up these enormous aid mechanisms?
Well, I think that was some of the good news of today, even though we're seeing these dreadful unemployment claim numbers and dreadful layoff numbers. But today, as you say, was the opening of the Paycheck Protection Program, as it is known, that $350 billion. And one of the things that I do think Congress did wisely in this legislation, and the administration as well, is not only put that pot of money there for small businesses and made those loans forgivable if you can prove that you are keeping your employees on or if you rehire them. And that's an important aspect too. If this is retroactive back to February 15th. So if you are a business that has let go of employees in the last couple of weeks, you go back, you rehire them, that would count toward your forgiveness. And the other thing that they did was wise is they are administering this through the Small Business Administration. But the SBA has in turn kind of handed over control of it to 700 different SBA authorized banks, private banks around the country. And moreover, did something that they don't always do, which is give those banks kind of full authority to green light the loans. So for some people, if you went in and you had your paperwork in hand, you could, in theory, be getting this money today or in coming days. It could happen quite quickly. And I think Mnuchin's reassurance that if it runs out, because right now it's on a first-come, first-served basis, but the reassurance that they would try to maybe fill that again is going to be something that I think is inspiring to a lot of small businesses and hopefully will put a, or at least stem to some degree the numbers of layoffs we're seeing.
There's also a new tax credit, an employee retention tax credit of up to $5,000 per worker. There's a pool of money, I think $500 billion, much of which will go to bigger companies. And that's a lot of money. On Thursday, Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that she's going to keep a close eye on it. She's setting up a House Select Committee on the coronavirus crash. And she named the South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn as the chair of it. And the goal here, she says, is to, here's the quote, she says, where there's money, there's also frequently mischief. We want to make sure there are not exploiters out there. Bill, do you buy her argument?
Yes, I do buy the argument that where there's money, especially government money, there's mischief. But it beggars belief that this comes from the woman who stuffed that $2 trillion bill with all sorts of money that has nothing to do with coronavirus. This looks like we expect the curve to hit in July of coronavirus, and maybe we can impeach Trump in August if all turns well. We have a lot of other watchdogs on this, including, I believe, a new inspector general. This is just unnecessary. And I frankly think Nancy Pelosi's behavior has been really disgraceful. And if it were Donald Trump, he'd be roasted for it.
Kim, do you agree with that assessment? And can you talk about some of the accountability mechanisms that were written into the law when it was passed?
Right. So this is why what Nancy Pelosi is proposing is patently absurd. And it kind of gets to the lie of what she's claiming they are doing here. When we passed that legislation last week, it already has two quite robust oversight mechanisms in it. One of it is a commission, a congressional commission. So we already have a body set up within Congress that's meant to be looking at this. In addition, as Bill mentioned, there is not only an inspector general for a portion of this loan program, that of the big loans that are going to go to bigger industry. But there's a body of inspector generals set up, a committee of inspector generals that span across the government that are also tasked with looking at this, reporting back to Congress where the money is going and how it's being used. Here's why Nancy Pelosi is doing what she's doing. Democrats, and one of the reasons that aid bill got delayed, was that they were fighting tooth and nail behind the scenes to give that Congressional Oversight Committee subpoena power. Because what they want is a version of that Elizabeth Warren committee that came out after the TARP bill, which was used by Democrats to beat up corporate America and the banking sector for years. And also, Democrats would see that as an opportunity as well to dig into the Trump administration and suggest that there was malfeasance and abuse, that this is kind of the machinery for a second impeachment. And it's why it's getting just smacked around by Republicans. There's nothing they can do about it, but it's a patently partisan move, and it's all designed about hitting corporate America and hitting Donald Trump. It's not about oversight.
And Kim, if subpoena power is the question here, I mean, the House Oversight Committee is already in existence and has that power, right?
Oh, absolutely. The only reason to do this, again, is to gear up an entire dedicated committee whose only job it's going to be is to investigate every cranny and nook and create scandal when there is none.
All right. Well, moving a little bit to the science end of the fight against the virus, the Food and Drug Administration has given its okay to the first test in the U.S. that can show if a person has antibodies for the coronavirus. Some countries like the UK and Germany are reportedly thinking about issuing some kind of immunity passport, for lack of a better term, where people who show antibodies on a test like this then can get out of their houses and go back to work, get the country going again a little bit. Bill, does that sound like a good idea or something we should consider here?
I think it's very promising. My understanding is that, unlike the swab, this is a fingerprint, a finger prick sample of blood. And my understanding is that the English public health system has ordered millions of these tests. Look, it's not the magic bullet. Nothing's the magic bullet. But if we can identify people that we believe are immune, they don't have to they don't have to stay at home. They could get back to work. You know, having real answers that gets chunks of our society back to work, back to what they're doing, that depends on information. And it's information on how many are affected, do we have the antibodies, can we use those people with antibodies then to immunize others? So I think it's a great development. Again, it's not the solution to the problem, but it's going to be one of the important tools, along with testing. I mean, the irony is, if you talk to the medical experts, they'll still say testing is the key. We're testing, I think we tested 120,000 yesterday, but it really needs to be up to 300,000 or 500,000. And in some ways, the testing to give us that knowledge may be more important than even ventilators, you know, which are for people in very difficult positions with the disease.
We're talking about the virus and the economy, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
One more thing specifically on the battle against the virus. President Trump has gotten into a bit of a public dispute with the company 3M, which makes the N95 respirator masks that are used by healthcare workers and are in very short supply right now. The company says it's bringing to the U.S. about 10 million masks that were manufactured in China. And meanwhile, it says the White House has asked it to stop sending any of the U.S.-made masks to Canada or Latin America, where it has customers. So 3M put out a statement, and it's an interesting quote here. It says, the company says, quote, "Ceasing all export of respirators produced in the United States would likely cause other countries to retaliate and do the same. If that were to occur, the net number of respirators being made in the U.S. would or being made available to the U.S. would actually decrease." Kim, who's right here?
Well, I think 3M does have a point. Look, here's the company's in a kind of difficult position. They are the primary producer of N95 respirator masks in the country, which are the ones that really are necessary for hospital and health officials to use, or health personnel to use in hospitals, because they provide the best kind of protection against getting the disease. And they currently, you know, they have now doubled global production, 3M, to about 100 million masks a month. They make about 35 million a month in the United States. And that makes up the bulk of the U.S. capacity right now, which is about 50 million masks a month. So I can understand the political reaction to say, you know, why are you sending any of these outside of the country? You know, we have a limited production capacity right now, and, you know, we need every one of those. But I think 3M makes a good point, which is that we are importing masks from other places of the world right now. And, you know, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also made this point, too, that is, you know, we are sending you guys supplies that you need, too. We kind of got to look at this as a global problem. We need to not shut down borders. So it's a very Trump thing to say, you know, to, like, you know, America first kind of thing. But it's not necessarily the kind of bigger view of how everything's working at the moment.
Meanwhile, the Centers for Disease Control still has not provided some clear guidance about whether the general populace should wear some kind of mask or scarf or something out in public. Bill, the original answer was no, that the science said it wouldn't help, that the virus is in small droplets that can go around, that kind of thing. Now the CDC is reportedly reconsidering its stance. Bill, what do you make of that?
Well, I'd like to hear what their answer is. My understanding is that most of the masks, if you wore them, you would protect other people from getting it from you, but you wouldn't necessarily protect yourself. I think that's a little different from the masks that that we were talking about before, which do protect people. I don't know. You know what I would like to see in addition to the advice? Again, I'm very big on rating the risks, you know, so that people know what to do and know, you know, which is more important than others. And I'd like to see the mask, you know, what people estimate if we get an order, this is, but I would suspect that washing your hands is still a lot more important. I'd kind of like to see some ranking to this thing. We ought to do this, we ought to do that, and no distinctions between what's the most important thing. I mean, I think American families, if you were told the five most important things to do, I think that would be a big help.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Bill. The most telling line in the coronavirus briefing on Thursday to me that stuck out was the coronavirus coordinator, Deborah Birx, made the point that we have now had this national lockdown for going on 2-3 weeks here. And her quote was, the people that we're seeing infected today and in hospitals today were infected after those guidelines came out. So clearly there's something more that could be or needs to be done. Moving along, while most of the country is shut down, politics is figuring out how to adjust. The Democratic National Committee was going to hold its national convention this year in Milwaukee starting in July 13, but that's now been pushed back to August 17. Does that much matter, Kim? I mean, are the conventions just a pony show at this point?
Well, at this point, no one's focused on this. And I can see, you know, their desire to put the machinery into place to push this off a little bit, so which you need to start thinking about now. I mean, don't forget, conventions are simply enormous productions. And so if you were going to move it and you had any worry that, you know, we could still be dealing with this virus in the middle of the summer, which is when they'd had it planned in July, you got to make that decision now. So I think it was a question of just being more cautious and making sure that, you know, they give themselves every opportunity. But look, I mean, we don't know where this is going to go. And we don't know, I mean, that both the Republicans and the Democrats may need to be thinking about a kind of very scaled down version of conventions. If we're still dealing with this issue, or there is still concern about mass gatherings in the middle of the summer, and so or at the end of the summer. So I think that this is just early contingency planning.
And there is an election that is scheduled to take place next Tuesday in Wisconsin, including presidential primaries. That's an interesting situation, given where the state of where the virus is now. Governor Tony Evers says that he intends to use National Guard troops to help work polling places where they don't have enough poll workers. And a federal judge on Friday, in a ruling, extended the deadline for absentee ballots. So we may not get results from that election right on election night. Bill, as other states think about how to handle this pandemic situation, either with their own primaries, a lot of which have been delayed from March and April until later in the summer, or looking toward the November election, I mean, how should they go about thinking about this?
Well, I'd like to see different states have different solutions. We have some, I think there are five states. I think, Kim, you lived in one where it's all mail ballots for all the
Oregon.
Elections.
Yes, we were one of the first ones. That's
right.
Where I grew up.
And
yeah.
I think Colorado, Hawaii, Washington, and Utah are also states like that. So it can be done. I mean, it kind of staggers my mind that in this age where, like, on my cell phone with my fingerprint, I can do so many things in a secure way that we can't come up with better ways to help people vote, but also insure against fraud. Because what I'm worried about, I'm not so much worried about Oregon or Colorado because of their experience. I'm worried about all these other places that don't have the experience, and I'm worried about the fraud. It just seems to me it's a lot easier to commit fraud. In there. It's interesting to me that in Wisconsin, which you mentioned, you know, the fight's been between Republicans who want to more or less keep the schedule and Democrats who are pushing for these changes. And I'm just wondering why they're pushing for the changes. And given the history, I think a lot of people want the changes because they see it as a opening for more mischief. And I think we can guarantee that with any of these changes, we're going to see a lot more mischief.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, the timing also makes it difficult. As I understand the situation, Governor Evers at one point said we should just mail everybody an absentee ballot right now. And the legislature, some Republicans said we don't have time to get that done given the amount of ballots and the short time frame here. And it will be interesting to see whether these changes that are pushed in states are written so that they're temporary for this year while we have this pandemic going on, or whether they're intended to be permanent. But Kim, what is the experience like in an all mail-in state? Did you miss having Election Day? Is there something lost there?
There is. You know, there's. I think this is why there's also kind of a natural pushback among many in the electorate to mail-in elections. And I certainly saw that among my family in Oregon when this was first coming online, is that there was a lot of resentment because people enjoy going to their polling place and getting their little sticker that said, I voted, you know, and you feel as though you've taken part of some great process. There are also, you know, real concerns, as Bill pointed out, about ways in which mischief can be done. You know, there's been a lot of discussion over the years, for instance, in Oregon and some of these other states about, let's say your elderly mother lives with you, and, you know, but she's not necessarily kind of on the ball. Do you take her ballot and fill it out for her and forge her signature and send it in, you know, or have her sign the piece of paper? She doesn't know what she's signing. I mean, there's a lot of kind of questions about what goes on in a household and, you know, and what happens in between that ballot and it actually getting back and counted. So those are some of the questions. I think more concerning to me is not necessarily the idea of using some form of absentee ballots or just making sure people have the opportunity to vote, but it's the other things that Democrats are demanding at the same time. Same day registration, you know, long early voting, which sort of changes the nature of elections in ways that Democrats at least seem to believe advantage their side in elections.
I'll raise two points of my own here. One was ballot harvesting, which is the practice third party, sometimes a partisan actor, like a paid activist, going around and collecting absentee ballots. Most states don't allow this, but California now does. And the registrar, I think of Orange County, I think it was at the 2018 election, said that he had people coming in with hundreds of ballots. I mean, that seems like a real election security issue. And then the second is, this is less applicable in a general election, but in the primary, you have a lot of candidates moving in and out. And if you look at the primaries that happened right on Super Tuesday, you had a lot of people who voted absentee or voted early for Amy Klobuchar, who was no longer in the race, or Pete Buttigieg, who was no longer in the race when that state's election day came around. So finally, one last thing. This week, Michael Horowitz put out another report on the FBI's surveillance tactics. Kim, can you give us a readout of what he found?
Yeah, this was a really important report, even though it didn't get a lot of attention. We wrote an editorial about it. I think a lot of the mainstream media and certainly Democrats would prefer that this not be in the news. But what he essentially found is he put out, obviously, in December, his big report on the FBI's abuse of the FISA process. And he explained in this follow-on report that the findings in that December investigation inspired his team to want to go and do an audit of other FBI applications to the courts. So they took a sample of about 29 of them, and they looked at what are known as Woods procedures. And these are FBI policy that requires that there be a file that exists that provides the documentation verifying that every factual claim in a FISA application is true and correct. And FBI policy is that you must have this file. It must be verified and signed by the case agent. It must be verified by a supervisor agent. Well, in this audit of 29 different applications, they found that they couldn't even locate a Woods file for four of them. And the other 25 of them had material errors, or not material. We don't know if they were material. They had erroneous claims and a lack of validation and information. Their Woods files essentially were a mess for all the rest of the 25 of them. So essentially a 100% fail rate, which means the FBI has been playing cavalier for a very long time with these applications, all of its applications likely in front of the court.
Bill, would you like to have the last word on that?
Yeah, no, I agree entirely with Kim. Look, we've been looking at this for a long time. And I think the bigger problem is there's no accountability. We haven't seen any yet for the actual people that filled out this reform. We know one FBI agent, I believe, lied on another form for Carter Page, but there are no consequences. I know they're putting into effect new guidelines and new training and so forth, but it seems to me that there are no consequences. You know, when the FISA law was first put up, Robert Bork wrote a terrific piece for the Journal talking about how this was a bad idea and putting judges in charge of these decisions is going to reduce accountability. Because what happens is then the people that fill them out say, well, the judge's going to look it over. If there's anything wrong, he'll find it. I think we're seeing how that worked out. And so what I'm hoping is that in addition to new training for FBI agents and a new insistence, that when you put your signature on that, there are real consequences if there's false or misleading information. And that's one thing we haven't seen yet, because there's just no incentive. Nothing's really happened yet to the people giving us bad information to spy on a fellow American.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.